My name is Walt Wandrin Jr. I always say Jr. Do you know that? My dad's sitting back there with his fingers covering his mouth. He's trying to figure out how he's going to act. Because I'm talking and he's not. I always say Jr. You should know that even when you're not around, I say Jr. Because as soon as I was born, I think you started to say Senior. Do you know what a load that is? You wake up in this earth and your father is saying Senior. He's the Senior. You're the Junior. Not a load. I'm entitling this whole series this week, five separate presentations, An Autobiography of Faith. Why I choose that title may become apparent fairly quickly in this first presentation. The title of this first one on the board is The Holy Other. Out there it said The Other, and then when Dad was talking this morning, I changed my title to The Holy Other. You should know that we are not going to play a ping pong game back and forth, my father and I. In other words, we're not going to take individual topics each day and play off against that single topic. What we are going to do is to take one whole thesis and then come at that thesis from two different points of view, two different directions. As the week goes on, you will begin to see how we fit together. Sometimes our fitting will be startling. It'll startle even us. Other times, you may need to see us as two elements of a metaphor, two elements that are finding a parallel as we talk. Dad said it this morning that our topic is the communication of faith, and then I can add to that, I would say also the conception of faith, the nurturing of faith, the growth of faith, the progress of faith, the drama of faith for an individual. Now, at the beginning, I'm going to focus primarily on children and what I think may be a paradigmatic experience. I'm going to look at my own experience and present it to you. But I'm going to hope that my experience might also plow the land for you and help you remember certain things that also happened in your childhood and in your past, where you may even become aware of what is going on for those little children that you have tagging around. Where are they?
Your daughters are your children.
You may become aware of the sorts of things that are happening for those children themselves. Dad will, I think, at least this is what we thought at the beginning, I thought so. Dad will identify some of the patterns of education and will draw contrasts between what is effective and good, and sometimes where the church has been ineffective and failing in some of its concepts of training people. I will try to give substance to that by reference to experience. I say I will refer to the children in the first lecture today and tomorrow, but then I will go beyond children and continue to pursue this drama of faith. As for me, it went all the way into my adulthood. I'm an author, and that gives me certain opportunities that I wouldn't choose on my own. That means that I'm invited to speak in places where I don't know the people rightly or well. And sometimes the fact that I'm also an author who's a Christian is known, and that means that people find it easy. This happens to you too, I suspect, in any profession or whatever, that people classify you and they anticipate certain things to come out of you, and may startle themselves when those things don't come out of you. I remember that I was invited to speak on an evangelical campus once, several years back. And they asked me to speak on, now these are phrases I'm beginning to learn belong to certain communities, and I begin to understand what's behind those phrases. They asked me to speak about my faith journey. Wheaton campus is the college. And so I took them at their word. They wanted to know what was the beginning of my faith journey. Where did I start out to get where I was? And I wanted to be as frank and honest as possible in answering them, and I'm afraid I bewildered them just a little bit without knowing why I bewildered them. I know now why I did, because I know now what they expected to hear. And I say they, but I would become very, very inclusive and say that this also touches our heritage as well. Many of you are Lutheran. That we may not use the word faith journey, or maybe we're just starting to use that word, I don't know. But we have certain concepts of how faith begins in people and how it is nurtured and where it grows and so forth and so on. And I began by talking. It was a big group of people, and they all, evangelicals begin smiling. You know that? That's really nice. They begin, and they smile benedictionally on it. And I noticed then that they were talking back to me by the wobbles of their heads. Because I began and I said, yes, I remember the very first experience that I had with God, where I was sensitive to the fact that there was a deity involved in this experience. I said, it happened on an Easter, of that I'm sure. And then they all smiled, benignly and kindly. There was a knowing nod. Yes, we understand this. I was beginning the story they had anticipated, I think. But I didn't know. I mean, I was glad that they were all with me. I said it was on an Easter. I said, whether it happened before church or after church, I don't remember. And their smiles cracked a little bit. But they were still smiling, because I was an author. I can get away with all kinds of things that way. I said, it happened at home. And I don't even remember what happened in the worship service that Sunday. I truly don't remember what happened. It happened in my home in Chicago on Overhill Street. In fact, it happened in the stairs going up to my bedroom. I slept in the attic. Dad fixed for us a bedroom in the attic. You'll know more about this bedroom as time goes on, because many things happened up there. Some terrible things. But what it was, one of the early experiences that I remember where there was a sense of the presence of the deity was an Easter egg hunt. Now they lost their smiles altogether. Easter eggs are paid. But it was an Easter egg hunt in our house. Now whether, you know, Mom, you'll be able to tell later on, not right now, whether this happened often or whether it only happened once, I don't know, but I had the sense that it happened often. Mom would hide the Easter eggs in the house. And I remember that she hid them throughout the lower story of the house, that she hid them in the living room and so forth and so on, behind the chairs, this, that, and the other. I remember on a particular Easter being frustrated at not having found all the eggs. I'm sure that my brothers and my sisters were helping me look for the eggs, but I personally had not found all of the eggs. And then suddenly, whether before church or after, I don't know. Given my mother's predilections, I suspect it was after church. But see, I don't even remember what happened in church. I began to hear my mother laugh. I was in the living room at the time, looking. And there came, out of the living room, through and into the kitchen, and then where the door went upstairs, there came this laughter. And it was at first just sort of a kind of a giggle. And I went to see where this laughter was, and there was my mother sitting in the stairs. They were behind the door. You could close the door, and the stairs went, you know, took a sharp right angle up between walls, and she was sitting there holding the egg that I had not found. And the impression that I have is that that wasn't the only time that egg had been hidden there, that I should have remembered that it had been hidden there last year, and she was laughing over my foolishness. And she was laughing at that point, I don't know if you remember, probably not, because what kids remember aren't what their parents hope that they remember. But she was laughing helplessly, and that was very infectious kind of laughter. She held this egg up triumphantly that I had not found and should have found. It was infectious, and I began to laugh too. And I remember that for a little while we laughed in utter and perfect harmony, and God was there. I didn't know the name of God. I didn't think the name of God at that point. I think, in fact, that my understanding of what the word God applied to had very little to do with my life and had a whole lot to do with worship and church and Sunday school and so forth and so on. But I knew that something tremendous was there, that there was a kind of perfection of harmony, that there was a kind of a music that I was listening to. But I was more than listening to this music, because I was laughing too. Therefore, I was participating in this music. It was also mine. It had been an invitation wordless. And it wasn't just my mother who was God, although that had something to do with it. It was the God above the both of us who was effective and who was active and who was doing something, but I didn't know the name of God. All I knew is that there was something almighty and there was something present. I said that at Wheaton College, and by this time they had ceased smiling. But I begin here with that same story because I need to make something of the point that Dad started to make this morning. I don't think that the child's faith is conceived in church except by baptism. I mean that faith in which the child actually participates. I think what I've just described to you is a holy thing. I think it was holy. I didn't know the words holy at that time, but I stood in a vast place, almost as the Oglala Sioux Indian would stand in a vast place when they went up on a pinnacle and waited a long time for a vision, but I didn't have to wait. I stood receiving holy acknowledgement, and I didn't know all the words of it. I breathed differently. The air tasted differently. These things are all true, and they had nothing whatever to do with church. And so I did not name it with the name of God. Nobody told me to name it with the name of God. Holiness. We began by saying the Bible is the Holy Bible, and I wrote it down. This is what Dad said. He said, it is holy when one understands that God intervenes in experience. Italics mine. He was mumbling at the time. In experience. Well, let me read that again. I just interrupted, and it's an important point. Holy, the Holy Bible, it is holy when one understands that God intervenes in experience to join human life. I like that. That means that its holiness is in this, that it recounts God's activity in the history of humankind. God was active. God did things. God became flesh. It was Jesus. Jesus acted in the same world in which we lived. It was here. That's what makes the Bible holy, because it is that recounting of the holy presence of the deity. I'm saying what you already know. I know that, but perhaps some corollaries come from this that are not so evident. Nevertheless, Dad also says Jesus was trapped into time and into place. Now, if our story of the relationship between God and all of the world is that, a story, is a history, a recounting of things which happened, where Jesus Christ was actually participating in the business and stuff of this existence, then I say to evangelicals and Lutherans and to anybody that so is the individual experience of a relationship with God a story and a history. It is not a collection of memorized proof texts. It is things which happened, whether they could be named or not, whether the child understood, likely the child didn't understand, nevertheless understood more than the parents, whether the child understood or not. It is things which happen. Now, all of you may find this a natural, easy thing for me to be saying to you, but I know that this word spoken to the churches explodes the doors. It shatters the concepts that puts godly and divine type activities into special places, under special litanies, at special times, with special relationships and special officiates officiating. What I mean to say is this, and perhaps it is wise for all of us not only to look at our children and our grandchildren, but ourselves this way. Christ Jesus, though in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, to be held on to. But this is what Jesus did. Jesus emptied himself and took the form of a human being, entered into history, entered into time and space, these things that you know, but humbled himself even further than that, to death. And then St. Paul says, even death on a cross. Now, we say that over and over again, and one of the corollaries of that understanding is that Jesus Christ, by a profound act of love, entered into the entire business of humankind. Anything of details or experiences or events that you wish to touch. Do you cry tears? Do you remember all the various kinds of tears that you cry? Tears when you hurt, although you're adult and you don't do it so much when it's a wound, but tears when your heart hurts. Do you cry tears of laughter? Do you cry tears of wonder? Are you sometimes shocked that you blooped out little tears when you didn't anticipate to do it? Jesus cried those tears. Notice that I say it like, Jesus. That's because I come from the South. But that's the point of this thing, that Jesus' humiliation and entering into circumstance means that he entered into all of this rough and tumble, this stuff and tumble of our lives, our existence, all of it. And then the passage goes on, as you know, and it suddenly hits from past tense to present tense. Please note the difference. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and given unto him that name. Well, it's perfect tense, but it's perfect present. And given unto him that name which is above all names. Now listen to how encompassing this is. Nothing in existence is left out. That at the name of Jesus, every knee, which is above the earth, that means all the spirit world, this is Paul's tripartite universe, That means everything that is invisible or floats above the earth, the angels, the dominions, principalities, powers, that every knee which is above the earth and on the earth, that means everything that we know, anything in our ken, these knees, as well as the little deer knees outside when they kneel down in the evening, as well as the insects and the ants, all living things and children. This is very comprehensive. And under the earth, which are those things below us, those things deeper than our ken, perhaps, where are you, Ruth? Are you here? I shouldn't do that. Leviathan, perhaps Leviathan. That at the name of Jesus, every living creature should bow the knee. And every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God. Well, that's present tense now. And what it says, can we take it seriously, is that in the person of Jesus Christ, God continues to affect authority over the whole of existence. Why will we divide our experience? Where does that come from? Why will we say that faith begins, well, in baptism, fine, but that it continues almost only in church, and if we could only get those kids to church, or Sunday school, or find the right pastor to teach them the right things, when I think faith will always be completely autobiographical. Always. Well, so, Dad will talk a little bit about the actual working of the naming of that faith for children. And I'm going to kind of follow two books as I talk to you. One is my own. I'm going to draw it on the Orphean passage, which just came out. The other, at least the pattern of the concept, comes from Surprised by Joy. Huh? C.S. Lewis, that's an autobiography of faith. And you'll notice that everything is involved. Nothing is left off. This is one of the, just a side point. This is one of the blessings that God has given me as an author. I see it honestly as a blessing. If I am forced to write true stories, now let's not say the truth now, let's just say true stories, then I have to observe very carefully. I have to watch the details. I can't miss the details, because the stories won't ring true to you unless I can get you to experience them as well. I have to see how people blink their eyes, how they move in their chair like this, and try to figure out what that means, why one moves a button back. Probably comfort, just comfort, I know. All right, so my profession forces me to watch, and ultimately it is in the watching of these things that I begin to draw on what God uses, both to conceive faith and to nurture faith and to nourish faith and to bring it up. There used to be a robber under my bed in Chicago, in that bedroom that my dad fixed up for us so well. This is the truth. When Paul and I slept up in that bedroom alone, Mom, there was a robber under my bed. This is all, No, even before that robber, I'll tell you how that robber got to have such power and strength for me, and how I understood that it could be there. It came from the snakes. I know that sounds silly, but it's true. Right next to our house, there was a prairie. Big, tall weeds growing in the prairie, and that's where we used to play. Remember that? And there? And we used to catch snakes. I had no problem with snakes. I had no fear of them. It was a marvelous thing, because when I looked at my parents, I was short. When I looked at snakes, I was big. I liked the snake. Well, and it was even more marvelous, because when I used to walk out of my neighborhood, a strange thing would happen to me, is that I would shrink. And I would get smaller and smaller, and, you know, as I went into strange places and unfamiliar places, I would literally get smaller. I know I did. The houses got bigger, the people got bigger, they got angrier and more fun. But next to my house, there were creatures that were slow enough that I could catch them. And that's exactly what we did. I remember once seeing my brother Philip walk along with a green snake, had bitten the hem of his pants, and it just dragged kind of like that. I thought that was marvelous. And went up and stepped on that snake and picked it up by the tail. Garter snakes were mostly what were there. And I would catch them, and they would twine up like this, because we always caught them by the tail. That's how we did it. I mean, I don't know if you know, but that's a professional way to catch snakes. If you let them get into tall grass and you reach down and catch a tail, they're very strong. That means that they can pull through that grass so hard that that tail will snap off, and it'll wriggle in your hand, which is a whole other kind of experience. It'll leave one dot of blood on the end of its wriggle, and the snake itself will go off with a stump of blood behind it. But I used to believe they could grow new tails, so it didn't didn't matter a whole lot. I would catch them. I did not do what Clyde did. Clyde took my breath away because he'd pick up a great big garbage snake like this and he'd snap it, like that, and break its back and drop it on the ground. And if I waited long enough, I could see its mouth open up like that and see the blood come out. I wanted to keep them alive, so I got mason jars. And we put them, coiled them up in mason jars. Now, see, now Paul was the brother right beneath me. He went, Wally, Paul, Phil. Wally, that's pleased to call me. Still loose. Wally, Paul, Phil, Mike, Deb, Greg and Dean. Deb wasn't there at the time yet, although she was born in that place. So Paul and I would fill up mason jars with snakes and keep them alive as pets in our basement and forget them. It was Mom who found the snakes in the basement. But I had no problems with snakes until there came a time when I went to visit Grandpa Wandrick. Now, all this may seem a diversion to you, but it truly isn't. This has to do with the growth of the relationship between me and God. That's how I am defining faith for you. Right now, I'm going to define it as a living relationship with the living God, not a proposition, but a living being, a living God. It is a living relationship with a living God, and I will add that it is worked out in this world. That's how I'm speaking of faith right now, and that's why the children may be involved, even though those little pagans don't know the names of things. And they may be pagans. I would like to say that this embraces all children. I don't think any children are left out of this. I think they have these senses, but their experiences will be unique and different. Mine was that I took a train trip from Chicago, where we lived, to Grand Rapids to visit Grandpa Grandma Wandrin. Now, while I was there, a thing happened which didn't bother me one bit. When I look back upon it now, I wonder that it didn't bother me. But on the way home, a thing happened which, in my Tonatetti's eyes, was nothing, but it bothered me so much that I was speechless. And I think I met something of the deity. But here is the difference between these two things. In Grand Rapids, my grandfather took me on a boat ride, and I don't even know what the river was. I don't remember anything except that it was a canopied boat, and that I was sitting next to my grandfather, who had white hair, pretty much like that white hair back there. And I heard over the speaker, they said, look over there to your left, there are deer. And I could not see the deer. I tried hard to see the deer. Grandpa said, I'll help you. And he took me to the back of this canopied boat. The canopy went back as far as the boat stern itself did, and he picked me up, I was that little, and leaned me out over the boiling waters and lifted me over the canopy till I could see the deer. I was not afraid. I was not afraid. I looked down, and I can see that rumbling, jumbling, boiling water right beneath me. He could have slipped and dropped me, but I was not afraid. There was something in that. At this point, I look back and I say, something marvelous was happening. That I could be put into a dangerous situation and not be afraid. It has something to do with community that I was not yet aware of. Now, I want to draw the contrast. On the way home, we took the train. Tonatetti, Dad's sister, and me. Well, no, was it Tonatetti? Maybe it wasn't. Was it? It was. Okay, good. Get these facts right so we can get to the truth. On the way home, it was evening. The sun, we were going south, and then we were going to turn southwest, and the sun was setting over the fields on the horizon. I was sitting on the right-hand side of the train, and I was a child full of curiosity. I wanted to see the engine. I looked out over the fields, and I don't remember what time of year it was, but they were green. And it seemed to me a wondrous thing, because green was going to golden with the sun. It was just right on the edge of the horizon. It all seemed to me that there was a mystery. But I was, at this point, not afraid of mystery. I wanted to see the engine that pulled this train. And so I put my cheek up against the glass, almost as though I was gnawing that glass and trying to see ahead. It was a long train, but it was going straight. I couldn't see the engine. And then, as though my desire changed the world, as though my desire had effect and power over the world, the train began to turn right. And I saw the engine begin to peep out like a black tongue in front of the whole train. And my heart went. I was up on the seat itself, and I was staring and watching that thing happen. And it was as though I knew some wonderful thing was going to happen, because my wish was being answered. And as it turned like this, all of a sudden, people, all of a sudden, it had an eye. And the eye flared red, and the red eye looked straight back at me. Well, I know it was the sun. I know now it was the sun reflecting off the engineer's glass, back of that locomotive. But to me, at that point, that was a snake's eye. And it was looking at me, it was looking at Wally, and I was transfixed. Because it suddenly dawned on me that nobody else in this entire train knew, but I knew that we were in a snake. And the snake had swallowed us down. And I didn't know how I was going to tell Tana Teddy. I was fixed against the glass. I was fixed, staring at this snake, staring back at me. And of course, I don't know whether all these images went through my mind, snapping snake backs and popping off tails and so forth and so on. But I will tell you this. I had no words for it, but my spirit knew that something horrible and tremendous was happening. And I think it was righteousness. I think it was that evil receives evil. I mean, that's what I was feeling at that point. I was terrified because I felt that somehow or other what I had been was now suddenly changing the universe, and it wasn't answering my wish and my will. What it was doing was taking on its own form and its own will, and it was laughing at me. It tricked me. I remember that I could not talk to Tana Teddy. I wonder if I knew something of autism. I don't know. For all the universe is living and strange, and you do not know its name. That is also a holy moment. I cannot get past the fact that fear is a part of it, all right? Very deeply a part of it, even though it lacks names. But the children will create a fiction. The children will begin to name things on their own. They won't even know to tell their parents. They won't even know to tell others, but within themselves they will begin to sketch in names, and they will begin a fiction or a theology. They will begin a story. And I did not catch snakes much. When the robber began to live under my bed, I believed in the robber. Do you see? The world isn't so fixed for children. It isn't so neat and ordered and named and kind. It is tremendous. And I think they're probably right. And we probably have protected ourselves in our definitions of order and our myths. Well, there was a robber under my bed. Now, you must understand, Paul slept in the same bed with me. We slept there together. And see, all I knew now of the truth, I don't remember much of what they taught me in Sunday school, Father. I mean, I'm sure that I remember things that stuck in my head and the stories that they told and so forth and so on. And I liked Sunday school. I did. I could tell you the things that I memorized at that point, the proof text, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him, though he... though he were dead, yet shall he live. No, and whoso liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Did I just switch over to the wrong one? I think I leaped from John 3 to John. See? Blew it anyway. But I know that in my own life and in my own experience, there were true and tremendous things happening. For me, however, at that point, the deity, I can't even say the word God over this because God was something else. The deity was the mysterium tremendum, as these fancy theologians say. It was the unknowable Almighty. I didn't know it, but I felt it knew me. It could look at me with the snake's eye, but it knew me in a different way. I don't know if I knew that it knew my name at that point. Or it was El Shaddai, good Hebrew way of speaking it. Almighty God. El is an indeterminate word for God. It could cover all the gods, Elohim. It could cover other gods besides the God that finally named in front of Moses the name Yahweh. It was El Shaddai, God Almighty. That's all it was for me. But it was there and it was real and I was in relationship with it, and that's all I knew. Until this robber. Oh, I'm getting to the robber. Well, the problem was that I didn't want to tell Paul about it. I mean, I was older by a year and a half, and so I needed to protect Paul from the robber. So I, when we went upstairs at night, you can imagine, I mean, this is a very narrow stairs that we had. Walls until you came to a banister in the top left-hand side. And you go up narrowly. And as we went up, I would make noise and all kinds of stuff to let the robber know we're coming. And I didn't, you know, Paul, innocent, come up behind me chattering and laughing and whatever. And we would lie in bed at night, and I would tell Paul stories, get his mind off of it. I even remember the stories that I told. I didn't want him to know that we were in danger of death. You think I'm exaggerating? We're in danger of death if I broke the rules. And I was only barely figuring out what the rules were. I was protecting, but it exhausted me. And when Paul finally went to sleep, then I didn't know whether I should stay awake or go to sleep. Because I figured that if the robber came out while I was sleeping, at least we would not be harmed. Do you see? That all the robber would do is steal things and leave. Wouldn't kill anyone or hurt my mother, my father, my sister, my brother, all that kind of. But I also was afraid that if I went to sleep, I mean, as long as I was awake, the robber might stay underneath the bed. It was a difficult, tormenting situation, night after night to go up with the robber. This is my first grade. This is when I would walk away from school and get tiny, 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 till I got, I mean, from home, and then when I got to school, I would get bigger, bigger, bigger again. It was a terrible world to live in. But it wasn't altogether hopeless. I decided I would tell Mom about the robber finally, when I was just too tired anymore from saving my family from death. Actually, what happened is she said, time for bed. And I said, no. She said, yes, time for bed. And I said, no. And she said, what's the matter? And at that point, Paul was getting set to go up without me, which is dangerous. And so I began to panic. And I said, I can't go up there. I can't go to bed. And I don't know if you remember, but sometimes when we had private talks, remember where we used to go? The bathroom. So we went into the bathroom for this private talk. I think that I probably sat on the toilet. Mom sat on the bathtub. And I said, I can't go to bed. And she said, why not? And I said, there's a robber under my bed. And she said, no, there isn't. I said, yes, there is. All of a sudden, you heard, I thought I was getting me a companion. And what I was getting was a skeptic, a critic. I said, yes, there is. There's a robber under my bed. The robber's been under my bed for months. I think as long as I was going to school, that robber was under my bed. No, there isn't, said Mom. And I pleaded with her, and I would. I went close to tears in the passion of this thing, because otherwise I'd have to go to bed. And so she said, she did what Mama is very capable of doing, to be very, very practical. She said, I'll show you. Which terrified me. That was the worst thing. I thought to myself, oh no, I never should have told her, because now I've endangered her and everybody else. She's gonna go and look. Now, I know that my mother is bold and brave. I remember that when we were in the mountains and the bears came nearby and everybody else ran and screamed or anything else like this, it's true. My mother would take pots and pans and climb the pots and pans till the bears, whoop, and ran away. But this was a robber. This was a robber, and she went out and my heart was beating, and this was a terrible thing. She was about to break the rules. I knew righteousness because I knew snakes. Nobody asked me, and I didn't think it was anything to say to anybody else, but like St. Paul said, there are two things you know about God at the beginning. And one is righteousness, and the other is creator. Those two things, you read Romans. And I knew righteousness, that the rules were not to be broken. But up the stairs she went, and I went up the stairs like this with my back to the wall, like this. Of course, Mom, nothing, you know, bears, robbers, anything. Went to the bed, leaned down at the bed like this, took hold of the coverlet while I was pressing myself back against the wall, whipped the cover off like that, looked underneath and said, see? And I looked under the bed, and there was not a robber there that night. I didn't blame you, Mom. You just didn't understand. If the robber wasn't under there when we went to bed, all she did was make it worse. Don't you understand? Because that means now that the robber might come in the window while we were in bed, awake. And it was back. I had lost my companion. I had gotten a skeptic. And even Paul knew that there was the possibility of a robber under the bed right now. Well, I had to do it alone, Mom. All by myself. First grade. Well, first grade was hard, don't you know? Max Gladick used to greet me always by punching me in the stomach. He thought that was fun. He really did. Hello, Wally. Boom. And I lost all my air. And there was a guy who was 13 years old with pimples on his face. Fire red, pimply face. He didn't like me either. And the snakes didn't like me. Well, see, what I'm saying is I was right. Mom was wrong. Mom was right. There was no rock. This is what I did. I took a plan all by myself. From that night on, when I mounted the stairs, I don't know if you remember this, this is the absolute truth. When I mounted the stairs to the bedroom, I sang hymns. At the top of my lungs, I sang hymns. I went ahead of Paul, I did. And I even remember the hymn that I sang as I went up. Day after day, I sang, Rock of Ages. I sang Rock of Ages, loud as I could. Jazz cleft for me. All up and down Overhill Street, they said, Mrs. Warner's child has got religion.
Let me hide myself in thee.
Because I figured that if I sang hymns, I would convert the robber before I died.
I am a Christian and would not kill me.
And people, I tell you this in all honesty, it worked.
It did. It worked.
Now, here's the point. As we begin, we can look back on that story and we can understand what was going on there. What I suspect goes on for all children is that they run flat up against evil. They run up against people who will punch them in the stomach for no reason at all, or people who have pimples on their face, or teachers who are not fair, or relatives and so forth and so on. They run up against that, and the child's way of handling this enormous business of evil is to translate it onto an imaginary level. Excellent book to read on this would be, and I didn't even tell the poor bookstore people, they'll be so upset with me, because it may not even be there, is The Uses of Enchantment by Bruno Bettelheim, who understands that children translate things we take rationally and reasonably into imaginary things and live it through, work it through, fight it through, experience it through in their imaginary level. There was a robber under my bed. I say that as an adult. What it was evil. What it was the evil I was beginning to discover in the world at that point. But I tell you this story because it was in my singing that I began to realize a new thing of the Mysterium Tremendum. That is, that it could also be good. That it could hear me. That there was some kind of a communication going back and forth. We today call this prayer. I didn't call it prayer at that time. Other things were prayer. Pious things were prayer. Church things were prayer. This was more important. I mean, I was saving people's lives here. But this was a part, I think, of this progress. Now there was a distinction. There was evil in the world, but there was also the possibility of good, which could be appealed to in hymns. Now this did then tangentially have something to do with worship. Some of the things at church did begin to fit into my understanding of the truth of the deity, such as hymns and so forth. But still the playing area for this was outside of the church. Now I was known, and the wondrous thing was, before I was known only indifferently, now I was known personally. How I still could not know that deity beyond saying good and listening. I couldn't know if it was, you know, now we talk about male and female images and so forth. At that point, there were no images. There were no images for the deity. Couldn't be. I hadn't had that much experience with meeting it face to face. I could believe it could meet me. I could believe it could subsume me. And now I could believe it could also listen to me. And that was a breakthrough. That was a wondrous breakthrough at the second level. But I did not know that I could know it very well. It still was almighty. Now, let me just pause for a minute at this point to say, do you see how well this child's knowledge, I keep saying to you, I mean for this to be a paradigm, and I suspect some of you are remembering these things yourself in your childhood. Do you see how well the children understand what the Hebrews kept trying to get across about the mightiness of the deity, the awesomeness, the awfulness of it? Martin Luther keeps saying, after every commandment in the what does this mean, we should
fear,
love, and trust. And then after we, first man, we forget about trust, we just fear and love. And then they always said to me that fear meant that kind of a stand in awe of, like stand in awe of the mountains and so forth. And so I'll tell you what, I think it's fear. I mean, I think it's just plain fear and love, and that there is a strange paradox involved in both of those things at once. And I say that because I'm looking at the children. What I mean to say is that the children at a certain level really do have a sense of the worthiness, the worshipfulness, the mightiness, the power, the awesomeness of a creating God. Which, when we end up talking about Jesus' buddy-buddy and all that kind of stuff, we lose somewhere along the line. There is something very Hebrew and pagan about those little children. Now, I'm finding three levels then, in just the infancy. This is even before there are names or knowing, before there are catechisms or proof texts. And even before the story of Jesus descends to give shape to all this and to give some kind of explanation. The first is this unknowable Mysterium Tremendum. The second is the beginning of a sense of goodness as distinct from evil, caringness, not perhaps yet the kind of caringness you get from a parent, mother, father. No, because this is too mighty and too distant and too unknowable. Isn't this marvelous? Doesn't it strike you? what drama is going on in the children's breasts, but I promise you it is. We often forget much of it, and I'll tell you tomorrow why we do. But I suspect most of us, at one degree or another, went through that. Maybe some of us are still in it and didn't want to say. But how much is religious? How much is dramatically faithful for the child? I think so. And then there comes a third level I identify, and it is a second breakthrough. It is also a breakthrough, and it's a wondrous one. For the child to begin to discover that her or his feelings and drama are not altogether private and unique, that others participate in the same thing, that this deity may be acknowledged by or manifest in community. This is a mark because it sets that child free from carrying the entire burden on her own shoulders. It suddenly admits companions. This is the first time that the child can begin to talk about these things to other people and to ask questions and to believe that what other people say has value. You understand what I just said? Up until this point, Sunday school and preaching and teaching all had its own certain kind of value, but it didn't always go straight to the heart of where the child was at. When the breakthrough comes, and when the child begins to realize that this same deity encompasses all people, and that that deity is also made manifest in communal activities and communal chatter and so forth and so on, all of a sudden, I, the child, may begin to listen to others and what they have to say about it and lend credence, or as we say, first time that faith becomes a kind of an evident believing, although it's been going on below all the time. Do you understand what I'm telling you? How important that is when all of a sudden just one other person is involved in the same drama. Just one. But then it'll be 2, 5, 10. But that experience is also experience. Oh, that's one. If you're taking notes, I have an outline in my head. That's one discovery. I mean, that when it's communal, you can communicate. You say, communal, you can communicate. Second one I want to get to, but let me just, it just dawned on me right now that we keep thinking we're communicating to kids ever before it's communal. And some kind of communication, I mean, they may be remembering, right? The words may be getting into their heads and the stories may be getting into their heads, but they're not easing the rubber under the bed at that point, or the snakes, or whatever their images were. So we are not communicating fully yet, until it's communal and we were all bound up in the same tremendous experience. Oh, shoot, I'd like to stop a minute and tell you what to do as parents. Tell stories. Tell stories where you don't be cynical and where the stories embrace the things that your children are feeling and you say, this is true. And then you companion. And sometimes the stories are out of scripture, but they're not told. You don't end the story by saying, now therefore, child, this is what you are to do from now on. Help your neighbor. As soon as you reduce the prodigal son to help your neighbor, what? All of a sudden, it isn't a story that names or identifies experiences they have had. What it does is kick them into experiences they're supposed to have, and those are two different things. There is a way, but that's not my point. The second thing that it does, which is marvelous, I'll put it in, I guess it's psychological, it authenticates the child to the child. The child becomes valuable. The child is able to do things now that have value and goodness to them. For the community. That's where, you know, when I discover that it's in the community and the community looks to me to be certain things, I have a place, I have a role, and then I am those things, I do those things, then all of a sudden it isn't Wally going through these private wars, these secret things, apart from everybody else, some odd, unfunctioning child on the side. All of a sudden, I am blessed and affirmed by community itself. I am Wally. I am. I like it. I am known personally, but now I am, because I am trusted. And the wondrous thing is that I'm trusted by the community as well as I am trusted by the deity that manifests itself in the community. I remember when I learned this, and I have one more story, also true. Grandpa, but this time Stork, taught me. I mean, I don't think that Grandpa Stork was doing it on purpose. He was teaching me all kinds of things. Grandpa Stork was the caretaker, director, superintendent, whatever you call it, of Concordia Cemetery in St. Louis. Seminaries is for the wanderers, cemeteries is for the storks. Well, that's all right, it's theological. We had C.F.W. Walther's monument there. under which I am told my mother and my father, Lucy, what do they do in those days? Spoon? Wooed? I don't know what. But my grandpa, when I went to visit grandpa, this is in St. Louis, he taught me things that were very important, and so I knew that I was important to grandpa, see. Spit and image, you said that once to me on a particular day, you said I was spit and image of grandpa. I kept wondering what the spit was. See, grandpa used to spit. He did, chew tobacco, didn't he? He had a big white mustache. See, I'm trying to still get to you. He had a big white mustache, and he had a spittoon in his office. He had a brass spittoon in his office, put it to the right side of the desk. And the man was Marx. Well, in those days, man. Marx man. He'd lean back in his chair, and my heart would begin to flutter because he was going into the trick. He'd lean back like this. He was chewing on a wad, and he'd spit into the air. One brown jet, shining. Now the child can put immediate experience into slow motion, and I'll watch that thing jet through the air like a pump. Beautiful dark brown liquid. Had a kind of a ball at the end of it, and a long comet's tail behind it. It followed the perfect trajectory up through the air like this. This is my child's mind. I don't know. And boom, hit that spittoon. Marvelous thing in my eyes. And he taught me things. I mean, he would take me around to the cemetery and tell me stories. He told me that when people die, their hair keeps growing and their fingernails and their toenails keep growing. He never smiled. Apparently, he didn't smile. Oh, true is what he did. And I thought that was, can you imagine what that did to my stomach? And he said he had opened up coffins and he'd look in there and yep, they had their fingernails all over. And I was walking on these people, right? They're all under this turf, right down there. Long fingernails, long hair. Somebody knew the Mysterium Tremendum as well as I did. Grandpa did. And he said that when they cremate, this is the truth, he really did. When they cremated people, they sat up. That made the hairs in my head go up like reeds. Just waving in the wind, sat up and screamed. He said, well. He said, the reason that they do is because their muscles contract, so they sit up in the air and their lungs expand. You see how marvelous this matter was? Spit, new about fingernails, and screaming corpses. And he used to show me, and I think I was probably the only one who knew this, the places in a cemetery where if you had to and you couldn't get back to the house, you could pee. Grandpa and me, pee. That's an image for you, I'll tell you what. Standing up, facing the wall, your big grandpa right next to you, standing there, and he's got a whole stream going. What you didn't have to go anyway, but you tried hard. Well, anyway, there came a day when we were in Chicago. We were not in St. Louis. We were not visiting at this point. When Mom said we had to go see Grandpa, and she said he's dying. We had to go down and visit Grandpa and he was dying. And the way in which she said it said to me that I did not understand what she was talking about. I was very small. I got small at her word the way I used to get small when I'd walk out of my familiar neighborhood and go through unfamiliar streets on the way to school, tinier and tinier. And it wasn't even as though Mom was saying it to me. It was as though she was saying it to the air, not to me. And that made me feel even more uncomfortable because I didn't know what dying was. I didn't know dying. And I didn't know what you do when you get near it, whatever it is. I don't know. So I became very quiet. And we drove then from Chicago to St. Louis, and I was quiet. Backseat of the car. And when we got to the cemetery and we got to the house, I remember that we came in the back door. And I began to think that I knew, but I didn't know what dying was. Because Grandpa wasn't in his bedroom, right? They had put Grandpa on a cot in the hallway so that when you walk into the kitchen, back door, kitchen, through that door frame, you could see Grandpa lying there in the hallway. And he was different. He was so different. He was, now, he used to be a big man, stork. Now he still had huge hands, but his arms were all emaciated. It was cancer, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was cancer. And his cheeks were in, and his white mustache was yellow, and his eyes were so big, except that they were like paper lids that were down halfway over his eyes, and he wasn't looking at me, and he wasn't looking at anybody like that. And it was as though I heard, so this is dying. And then it was as though I asked, oh, what do you do? What do you do for dying? Nobody told me. Well, much of my drama and much of my experience was private anyway, and I didn't even know to ask anybody, what do you do for dying? Except that I felt extra. I felt like one too many people in the room, and I was the one who was too many. And I felt responsible somehow. And his cheeks were all sunken, and his temples were all gone. And then we got ushered into the living room right away. Kids, we went into the living room. And I sat there trying not to be. I didn't know what was going on in this house. But I'll tell you what, it was not far away from some of these other things that I had gone through. It's just that it had a name I had never heard before, and it was called dying. So I sat very still. I was not a bad person then, although I thought somehow or other that there was badness involved in this, because everyone was so quiet, and nobody was looking me in the eyes anymore. I was aware of that. They would look past me, they would speak in short phrases, and they would do things suddenly, and they would expect me to hear the first time, but they were not looking me in the eyes anymore. And it was as though somehow or other I was responsible then, that I had broke relations with them personally. Grandpa Stork remembered me. Now, I don't know whether he did this to all grandkids or whether all the people or what, but Mom came to the living room and she said, Grandpa wants to see you. Well, I was going into a strange neighborhood, and so I went very tiny. By myself, it seemed. I went round and I looked to where Grandpa was, lying in his bed like that, looking up at the ceiling, and I was so small, and no one said, what are you doing for dying? I didn't know. Grandpa rolled his head over to his right side, he was on his back, rolled over to his right side, and he opened up his eyes, and he looked at me. He looked me in the eyes. I do not remember if he said anything. I don't know if he said a word, but what I know is he did something. And what he did was to teach me, what do you do for dying? And it was as though he set me free. And it was as though I grew to normal size instantly. Grandpa took that huge hand with his skinny little arms behind it like that, and he reached it over like this to me and did what he had done so many times before. He put out his hand to shake my hand. I knew what to do. I knew about handshakes. I was free. My legs were no longer locked. I wasn't guilty, I wasn't wrong, I belonged there, with my grandpa, he and me, we belonged together, and I moved my legs, my little legs, and I walked over to grandpa, and he took that hand and made my hand disappear in his hand, and he looked me in the eye, and he shook my hand once. Two weeks later, we were at home. I think it was noon, as I was sitting at the table in the kitchen. I think I was eating, but I don't remember. We got a telephone call, and I knew what that call meant from the rings. I knew. You know a lot of things when you've been struggling with the mysterium tremendum, yay, 6 years of your life. Mom answered the phone. Our phone was through a hallway in the dining room on the wall, attached to the wall. And she answered the phone and I watched her. And she spoke very low and very quiet. And then she put the phone back under the hook like this and she put her head against the wall. And I knew what it was. Grandpa was dead. Grandpa had died. Grandpa was her dad. But I knew what to do for dying. Grandpa told me. I got up where I was sitting behind that kitchen table, and I walked from the kitchen through that hallway into the dining room. I think I was probably 6.5 feet tall then, because I knew what to do. I was free. I was Wally. I was real.
I was important. And I went to my mother with her head against the wall like that, and I suppose that if I was 6.5 feet, then she must have been 44 feet. Because I had to reach up and grab hold of her skirt. And I pulled on her skirt like this, and she looked down to see me. And I knew what to do. Put out my hand. And she put out her hand, and I took Mom's hand. This is what you do when your dad dies. I don't know if you remember this because it's so tiny, but I know it worked. Sort of like pulling on a pump handle. Pulled her mom's hand. Found it being my mother. But that's okay. I could hold her up and hold her. Because that's what she did. Or there comes a time in a child's life, and many children don't even remember this, and it is a sad thing if some children don't even have it, that at the most important events of the community, the child is invited. And the whole community stands before what had been the mysterium commendum. And it isn't a made-up thing. It isn't pretend, people. They're not pretending, as children sometimes know happens in the worship service. And it isn't just a teaching thing. It isn't just giving words patronizingly, matronizingly to little children, where the children know that there is a vast difference between themselves and those who are teaching them, because those who are teaching know not only all the answers, but also all the questions. There comes a moment when the child is invited into the whole life of the community, when the community stands before things as heavy as dying, and the child is given an opportunity to be. And then that child, from that point on, can begin to ask questions, because the child discovered others have been in the same death. And that child can begin to ask questions, because the child also knows that she is important, and they will tell her the truth. They will not lie.